Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Footmarks. I'm your host Varuna Lukun and I'm joined by Jared Kimber. Today's episode of Footmarks is on the judgment of Pope. And before we get to the actual podcast, these podcasts are mainly powered by our Patreon. Make sure do go and subscribe to it. It's patreon.com/goodareaspodcast. So Jared, on the final day of the Edgbaston test, you were sitting in the TalkSport studio. And for some reason, I think that the ghost of Nostradamus took over you. And then you could sense the fact that Ollie Pope would be bold. Talk us through that.
I wasn't in TalkSport, actually. I was in the main press box. Oh. But I had all the TalkSport guys next to me on one side. I'm trying to think who was on the other side as well. And yeah, I was suddenly... It's really weird. It's like I was watching the game. But there's sometimes you're like watching the game and sometimes you're like in the game, if that makes sense. And, you know, sometimes you feel very much like a third party sort of viewing it. And then other times, you know, because you, especially when you watch as much cricket as someone like I do, you know, sometimes you're just like, oh, I can see what's happening here. And suddenly I kind of look up and was it Akash Deep that was bowling to him?
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah. Akash Deep's bowling to him and I'm just like, oh, he's going to bowl him with this ball. And then I sort of think to myself, what a stupid thing to think. Like, what are the chances that happens? And then he does off the next ball. And I haven't said anything to anyone. But now I'm turning around and I'm like telling people around me and they're all like, yeah, it's Ollie Pope. Yeah, we get it. Like, you know. But in my mind, I was like, no, I mean, I actually thought he was going to be bold on that delivery. And I don't know where we were in our piece at that point. Varun, if I know you'd already given me the stats, but I don't even know if I'd started writing it at that point or if I just started thinking about it. But I kind of felt like I became the Ollie Pope whisperer at a certain point where I could tell you exactly what was going to happen. Again, the other day when he was playing, you know, I was just like, yeah, he's not going to get past 20 here. This is what he's going to do again. And you start to get to a point of like, am I just a genius cricket watcher or is it that I have watched so much Ollie Pope and his patterns are so pronounced? And I think we'll find out through the course of this, Varun, that it is very much, I've watched a lot what's his name? Ollie Pope.
Yeah, I think for the Pope piece, for some reason, I think we started talking about this after Headingley when he didn't do well in the fourth innings of that test, from memory. Yeah. So that's when the idea came about. I don't know if we had the exact, like the direction of the piece then, but we were definitely, we need to do a Pope piece. I don't think anyone anticipated the direction we went in.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think I knew how much, I knew he was bad in the fourth innings, but you know, what does that mean? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I didn't know he was like maybe the worst fourth innings batter in the history of cricket. Like, I didn't know that. And I think you guys put something on the group and someone might've mentioned it on Discord again. Oh, Ollie Pope fails in the fourth innings. And how do we get on the median side of things? Because for me, it was when the two points came together where I was like, wait a minute, he might have one of the worst medians ever and one of the lowest fourth innings. And that's where I was like, oh, this is not just like 8,000 word piece. This guy's weird. This is not a normal cricketer to have, you know, in a situation. And then I kept sort of throwing things at you and you kept finding more weird and wild stats about him. And then when you gave me the graphics, there are all these other stories, like the Grant Flower story, right? And the Marvin Attapattu story and the Steve Smith story. And suddenly you're like, oh, this Ollie Pope is maybe the most interesting batter of the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, as far as not the best, right? Not the best to watch or the most fun or whatever, but he might actually tell you everything about modern cricket in one go.
Yeah, I think it's, if you want to like to tell someone what good areas is, I think we just show this piece and be like, we nearly wrote, how many words did you end up writing about Pope? Like 4,000?
I can tell you how many 5,000? The original draft was. The original draft was 7,500. And I think we brought it into a brisk 5,700, Varun.
Yes. I think to give people an idea, I think our usual pieces are like 1,500 to 2,000. That's roughly where I think we aim for. And if we're stretching ourselves, it's like 3K. So this is beyond, I think, anything we were all originally thinking of. So, Jared, let's just go to the very beginning with Pope, right? On March 28th, 2017, there was a match for Surrey versus Oxford. I don't can't remember. I think it must have been the university, Oxford University, right?
It was. The combined universities team, I think they called or something.
And Ollie Pope is batting at 7, which is very bizarre to me. And for some reason in the Surrey team, where everyone ends up playing for England at some point, he was the ninth player from that team to get it, right? Or was it the eighth? Ninth,
he might have been the 10th, wasn't he? Wasn't it 9 already? I think, I can't remember if Curran plays before him Or so Curran maybe is the ninth, Pope is the tenth, and there's one person from that lineup.
Yeah, sorry. Sam Curran is ninth and Pearly Pope is the tenth.
Yeah, and yeah, I think I can't even remember who the 11th player is, but he's the only guy I think who never went on to play for England from that team, which does tell you that Surrey has a lot of talent. But I was shocked at that. And, you know, that was one of the things I found that you didn't find, where I was like, wait a minute, this is a guy who made his debut batting at number seven for Surrey. And then how long after is he playing for England? And he's batting higher than that. Like, it's, how many days was it in between? I know I wrote it in the piece.
499 days.
How does this happen? Like, I know Surrey, mm-hmm. Surrey is different, right? Because as we just said, there's so much talent there. But he was batting behind Sam Curran in that lineup. Like, it's not as if, it's not as if he was being, like, it's a university side, dude, right? Like, you're not hiding him from anyone. He went out to a Zimbabwean who's a batter, right? Like, it's, he didn't go out to, like, some star player or anything. And so I instantly, I was like, something happens in these 400 days and England isn't ready for it. Because you look at it, even when he plays for, before he makes his debut in Test cricket, he plays for the Lions, right? And they bat him at, what, five, I want to say, or six in that game. And then suddenly, no, in the Lions game, when he plays for the Lions a year later, he's batting down the order again. He's batting at five or six or whatever. And then when he plays for England, he's back up the order again. So his career in England makes no sense. Like, it, they just picked him because he'd been batting really well for a year. And mm-hmm. I remember Dan Norcross at the time. One of the reasons I remembered all this is because Dan Norcross had been doing a lot of commentary for Surrey, and he's obviously a Surrey fan. And he was like, this guy's not a test number four. This guy's barely played any cricket, and you are throwing him to the Wolves at number four in a test match. Like, what's going on? And then when you do the research, and I was expecting to see, oh, he'd been playing for a couple of years, and he'd been batting at number five, and England's like, whatever. And it's like, no, he'd been playing for basically just over a year, and he started as a number seven. Like, it's all over the shop, the way that Pope was treated by England early on. And a lot of that probably has to do with, there were some injuries for that game. And also, they just hadn't had a player since Joe Root who had looked like making any runs.
Yeah, definitely. Also, I think the game he debuts is a very strange game, but Chris Wokes gets 100, and then India played Kuldeep Yadav on a very green pitch, which there was rain. So I think he was actually helped out by India's bat selection. I think if India played three seamers, three frontline seamers, it might have been even worse for him, I think, at times.
Both teams, going back and looking at that, that is one of those lineups where you look at it. I said it to some of my friends going, what is this? Wokes bats at seven, doesn't he? In that lineup.
Yes. It's like, yes.
Everyone's an all-rounder. It's a mad team. And as you said, the Indian team is just as weird. Like, it was a really, you know, it's one of those, what test was it? It was the fourth or fifth? Third test?
Must have been the third, right?
Third, yeah. It's one of those tests
it can't be the third. India win the third test match.
I can't, but it feels like one of those tests where, like, you're in the middle of a series and things aren't going exactly the way.
Oh, second test.
Yeah. So you're in the middle of a series and, like, things aren't going your way. There's a couple of injuries and teams just go, I don't know, let's just put an 11 out there and see what happens.
Yeah, I think from memory, like, was Stokes injured in that game?
Play.
That must be the only reason Wokes is batting in the top seven, right?
Yeah, well, I don't know, because I think that's the reason he's in the team. I think he's kind of replacing Stokes' batting in the team. But mm-hmm. he bats at four and Stokes wouldn't have batted at four. So it is a bit, I think Bairstow is keeping in that game and Bairstow's mm-hmm. at five. And so they're probably thinking, we don't want the keeper at four. And I think that was when Root was batting at three, you know, during that period. So, yeah, it's a really weird debut. And traditionally, if you had someone like Pope debuting there, he probably bats at six or seven, right, in that kind of game where he's not that experienced, he's coming in, whatever. But because of the Bairstow-Wokes situation, I think they're probably a little bit more hamstrung. Butler's playing in that game as a specialist batter, I think.
Yes,
as well.
That was about to say. That's the specialist Butler days.
You think the Pope video is long? Wait till you see my draft on the Butler Bairstow one. I promise you, it is. It will kill our video team. In fact, it did actually kill off a video team at one stage. But yeah, so it's a six or seven You know, six or seven is where he would have played, but you've got Wokes as the all-rounder because of Stokes not playing, and then you've got Butler as a specialist batter for no reason at all, the stupidest decision in the history of mankind. And so you end up with a situation where Pope has to bat at four, and it's just like, what a bad way to start your career.
Yeah, although I think even though Pope does start weirdly at four, to be fair to England, I think Ollie Pope might have been the last specialist rookie at six we've had. In Test cricket, I think in the mixtape era, we were talking about how because of the all-rounder, because every team is playing an all-rounder in the top seven, that essentially the graduate position has gone out. But because at that point, I think England either had their best, who was a keeper who could bat in the top five, or they had Stokes who could bat in the top five, that allowed them to have Pope at six. And he does start at six, and they do give him some time. And he eventually, I believe, just before COVID in South Africa, he does well. I remember that series very well for me. I think that might have been the first and last time where people were hopeful about Pope.
Yes, and really hopeful about Pope is probably the best way of putting it there as well. You're right. He probably is. I think you and I have got that on our list of pieces to do, right? The sort of the death of the specialist number six batter, and certainly the death of the sort of easing players in that position, which just doesn't happen anymore. Like, you know, people have kind of forgotten that Ricky Ponting starts as a six, right? Does Sachin start as a five or a six as well, I think?
Yeah, Sachin is a six. I think someone corrected us last time. Because Azhar wanted to remain at five, Sachin goes from six to four directly.
Yeah. So he sort of switches over, doesn't he?
Starts at six as well, yeah. Smith, I think. Smith, like, even the Fab Four started at eight at some point. Smith started at eight. He had an extreme graduate position, let's just say.
Did he actually start at nine? Because I reckon the first time he bats in Test cricket, I think Mitchell Johnson was a night watch and went in ahead of him. The only reason I know that is because Smith has said, oh, they batted me at nine. It's like, they didn't bat you at nine, dude. That's like Michael Jordan getting cut from your high school basketball team. They batted you at eight, which is also an insult, but they didn't bat you at nine. You're right. He was at eight. It might have been the second innings.
The first innings he's at eight, and the second innings, I believe, he's at nine.
Yeah, but that's what I love about the great players. Every potential slight they've kept in their mind forever, right? So you've got this situation there where, as you said, he's getting hyped. He's made so many runs in county cricket, and there's no young players who've made runs in county cricket. Like, Bairstow, Root are the only other two, and they've obviously gone on to have pretty fantastic careers. Everyone else has made zero runs, right? And so he comes through, and I think there was always an apprehension around him at Surrey only because they don't really push him up the order. And I think that's an interesting, Divanuto might have been coach at that time. I'm trying to think back who would have been captain. Maybe Gareth Batty would have been captain for some of that. But I think there was a bit of a, he's good, but he's probably not like a number three. So he bats a little bit lower in first-class cricket at that time. But he is the only guy making runs in first-class cricket. And so he makes runs in South Africa. And John Norman at TalkSport sort of says, I want to know more about this guy. I don't know if John was skeptical, but I don't think John thought Ollie Pope was as good as the hype was on that tour. And that, as you said, that is the maximum of the hype, right? Everyone is going, this is the next Joe Root and everything else about him. And so I go through and do the analysis, and I kind of come up with two major things. One is that he can be slowed down by good deliveries outside off stump, which I thought was not a sign that he was terrible, but a sign that there was a way of... you could bowl to him. There was a place to bowl to him. It wasn't one of these situations where it's like, no one's found out where to bowl to him yet. Actually, it's a pretty obvious place at the moment. You bowl length outside off stump and he'll probably leave it or defend it. He doesn't really have a shot to sort of move that ball away. So a Vernon Philander, who was on that tour, but literally not, he was done. But a Vernon Philander type bowler could have really caused issues for Pope. And then the other thing was that how slow he scored against spin in first-class cricket, considering he was playing it in county cricket on wickets that don't suit spinners and against second-tier level spinners, right? Or third-tier level, depending on how you want to look at that, right? And so I tell this to Mark Butcher and Gareth Batty, and I don't know if you've listened to the audio, but they are like brutal, right? And these are my friends. So it's a little bit of we're on air and they're having fun. But they were brutal, and Butch and Bat Slater were like, mate, come on. Now, how did he end up playing spin, Varun?
As we, I think, mentioned in the piece, like, he can't strike routine versus spin to save his life.
Yeah.
And also, like, he's terrible at versus spin when he's on his back foot as well, right? and he can't use his feet to spin. And that, like, there's a very like brief like area of spin he can play where he's on his front foot and he's not trying to almost like dance down the wicket or strike rotate.
He's
it's good very at the, strange.
He's very good at the long forward press, the sort of traditional way of, especially an English player would play spin, right? He is very good at that, getting forward, smothering that ball. The problem is, as you point out, is if it's slower than that and he has to use his feet, he's dog shit. Like literally dog shit. And weirdly, he's terrible on the back foot. Like he's like a number eight on the back foot. Like, you know, one of those guys who just gets trapped and doesn't know what to do. And so you have this weird pattern where if the ball is pitched on the exact right length to him, he's fine. And the minute it's a little bit shorter or a little bit slower, he's like, he's got no game against it. And to go back to what you were saying as well, that was the thing I noticed in the first class pattern, right? Which is he cannot rotate strike against spin. And none of that has changed. He's better against spin now than he probably was when he first came in, which is makes sense. He, you know, he's maturing and he should be becoming a better player. But he still now doesn't know how to rotate spin. He basically knows how to block it on the front foot and how to hit boundaries off it. And everything else is like this mystery that he doesn't understand. Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible now. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. And amongst all of this chaos where England give him a graduate position initially, just tell him, okay, you can chill at six. He does well. Then he has a bit of a dip. And the Bazball England bring him back. And they tell him to bat at three, which is one of the toughest positions in Test history. And what we probably didn't know in 2022, as we do now, is number threes were going to basically become a very bizarre species in cricket, where it's like, it's almost like, I can't remember that. How many great number threes do we have right now, right? Because at least at that point, you could be like, well, you had Marnus and Kane Williamson, if I'm remembering correctly. Pujara was still maybe kicking about.
Yep.
So it's like, so there was still, it was not completely hopeless, unlike now, where it's like, it's a bit grim, Jared. Like, false threes are starting to take over right now. And I honestly cannot, like, England bringing back Pope at three is, like, we may not have, like, called it out then, but it is the most Bazball move imaginable.
Yes, it's really interesting where I think, again, and I have to give credit to Brendan McCullum. He's very good at just going, I back talent, as in, Ollie Pope was probably in their best six natural batting talents, right? Like, I don't think you or I would argue against that. We might, we might say that there's an issue with that and they don't have a lot of batting talent, but we wouldn't say that he's not in their best six or so. And so McCullum's way of doing it is different to probably how we would traditionally do it, which is he's just like, I just want the six best batters and we'll work out the positions later. Maybe McCullum doesn't spend as much time looking at data as you and I do. And so he might not know that number three is becoming this unplayable position in modern cricket, right? Like, you know, we go through it in the piece. You have guys who are the third best opener in the team batting at number three. So automatically, they're not as good as probably the first two guys, right? Let's call him, you know, that sort of Joe Denley. I mean, Eddie Cowan did it briefly. Like, that sort of player sort of becomes a number three, you know, because you have to put someone there. Then you have
Zach Crawley.
Yeah, Zach Crawley. Yeah, I forgot about him. Yeah, he was definitely another one. So then you kind of move on from that player to the sort of, I suppose, a sort of Cameron Green type player where you just have to fit that extra batter in, which is what Ollie Pope becomes. And we move on to this other thing, which is our false threes, right? Which is, I think I picked Raymond Reefer as the most false of the number threes, just because it's hilarious he ever batted a number three for his country. He's like a number seven or a number eight player, you know, and that teams are now trying to cheat and get a little bit more bowling in. Vian Mulder is obviously another one. you know, we're seeing teams just go, like, let's just put anyone up there. Because if I think VR Mulder was told, and I'm trying to remember the full conversation, but I think he was told something along the lines of, if you can get to 30 to 40 balls, right, you've actually done the job that we need you to do at number three, right? Which is, that's how much that we've gone from Brian Lara and Kumar Sangakkara to Vion Mulder, can you face 40 balls? Now, obviously, Vion Mulder's done spectacularly, right? But Jacob Bethel's another one as well. We are literally just throwing in anyone at the top of this order now because it's so hard to find someone to do that. And so Ollie Pope is probably halfway between a false three and that sort of Cameron Green style of just like someone else in the order that isn't quite suited to it. And then, but on top of that, you're kind of throwing him in when it's really tough anyway. Like, if Marnus can't make any runs, and Marnus is obviously more talented than Ollie Pope, like, what are you going to do?
Yeah, Pujara, I think, went from averaging like nearly 15 test cricket to barely averaging above 40 by the end of his career, right? Amongst that decline. So I think credit to England. I honestly don't know how else they could structure these exact like six or seven set of players without, I think, reducing the runs. Because essentially the way I look at it, like if you see the batting order, almost like a game of Wordle, where some spots are yellow, some are green. What you're trying to do is get as many to be green as possible to get the highest average output. So I think we were talking about before, like Root was batting a three, and he was not as good at three as he was at four. So I think at that point he was averaging about 48 to 50 at four, and is about 38 at three. So he lost about 10 runs moving him to three. The issue wasn't that Root lost runs, it's that they could never find a number four to make up that difference. I think in a similar thing, this version of Root is even better than that. Let's say this version of Root's averaging 55 to 60. And if he bats at three and averages 45, I honestly don't know if Ollie Pope is good enough to get 10 to 15 on his average batting at four. So it doesn't make any sense for them to move that around, right?
No, I suppose the only thing that they could do, and they wouldn't have done it recently because he was out of form, but could you make an argument with Ben Stokes, the way he's been playing spin, that he'd be better off at three than he would be at six? Maybe you could make that argument. Or if Wokes was still fit, could you have made the old Ben Jones argument of that? What, you know, I think by this stage, Wokes' batting had already dropped off. But yeah, if you had another version of Wokes coming through, I don't know, even the Sam Curran, right? Could you have done something like that? But yeah, I think your general point is pretty accurate. There isn't really, and this goes back to the McCullum thing of like, you look at the order and you're like, well, where else are you going to put him? The weird thing about Pope is, technique wise and everything else, he's probably a number five, right? I would say. The issue with that is that's generally where your best bats go now. But also, do you really want a number five who gets stuck against spin? So I don't know what his best position would be. If you're asking me honestly, I don't know where you would get the most runs out of Pope. I would assume taking him away from the new ball would get you a five-run boom. So if he went from three to six. But I don't think he'd suddenly, as you said, average 45, right? Like, I don't see this huge regeneration of him, because the further down the order he plays, the more he has to start against spin. And I think for all of his issues was against spin, I think a lot of them are when he has to start against spin is when he's at his absolute worst. I don't think he's quite as bad when he's been facing pace bowling for a little bit, you know, which is, that's very normal of Western players, right? Like, Asian players are so used to coming in and starting against spin in any position. Whereas if you're in the West, generally, and you're batting in the top four as a first-class cricketer, it's very rare for you to come in and start against spin. You're generally starting against pace. And so there is a disconnect there. But yeah, I don't think there's like a magical position that you put Ollie Pope in and suddenly he's averaging 45.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Although I'd argue that, I think if the median entry point for like the number five is about the 24th over, could you not argue odds are that the teams are not bowling spin at that point, right? Especially in Senna. Like, maybe in Asia, of course, you'd face spin by that point. But yeah, like in Senna, I don't know how many teams, maybe Australia bring up Lion at that point?
You would have to look at the numbers of what the first 20 balls a player bat faces at, you know, or 50 balls even, faces at number at five compared to three. But I would assume that even if it's not, it's maybe not 30 balls, maybe it's 20 or 25, whereas at number three, it's probably closer to 5 to 10. So there's still a big difference there. But you're right. And also, taking away from the new ball sometimes would also just help, because he's not a particularly great player with the new ball either, right? Like, that's another thing that you found in your numbers of when he comes in early, he's also not particularly good, right?
Yeah, I think if you, from memory, I think he's, well, I actually need to check this. I think Venny enters before the
is this us, seventh. Uh, having, after, Yeah, sorry, go.
Yeah, sorry. Before when he at number three, before he enters the seventh, before the seventh over, he's averaging 35, and when he's entering after the seventh over, he's averaging about 48. That immediately tells me that he's not a number three. Like when the disparity is that high, I think it's like that's a bit concerning to me.
No, I 100% agree. And
yeah,
as I said before, I just don't know. I suppose his real spot would be the Asad Shafiq role, probably, isn't it? The number six. sort of permanent number six. I'm trying to think of the last person before Asad. I mean, there really aren't people who ever did it consistently. But that sort of role is where you could see
VVS, Ollie Pope.
Who? Yeah, VVS a little bit. I mean, but
VVS. Yeah, it's not a lack of talent, right?
Yeah, VVS is probably a number four or number five, isn't he? Yep. It's just that you can't fit him any further up the order, and they needed a left-hander in that top five. But yeah, no, you're right. So you end up in a position of, I don't even know where Ollie Pope really goes, but if I was saying what is his perfect position, it is probably a number six in a Western country.
Yeah, I think that's more than acceptable. But then here's the other argument I have, Jared, against that. So the reason we usually don't want your best batters at six is because at number six, the odds of you maximizing your great days are very low. Right, so one of the reasons I think the best batters usually move to three or four is you don't want them to get to 75 knots out and run out of partners. Yeah. You want them to get a 150 or 200. And we know that from what we found about Pope is very dependent on the good days. And if you're a number six and the odds of you getting a good day are lower, would that not essentially be like a loop where if he's not great at starting and he's not going to have the ability to maximize his good days, would the average actually change that much for him?
No, I don't. That's what I'm saying. I don't think there is a magic spot where I don't think there's a magic spot where he's averaging over 40 consistently in Test cricket. There's nothing within his game that makes me think that we're going to find that number now. Like, you know, if you factor in some of the crap, the crappier teams, you know, Ireland and Zimbabwe, I know he averages over 40 batting at number three. But he doesn't in the World Test Championship, right? Like in the World Test Championship, he averages a lot less than 40, right? So, you know, against the best teams, I don't think there's a number where he's suddenly going to be, oh yeah, I could see this or whatever. And he's also never going to be good enough that the batting lineup is around him. Like, we don't know a lot about Jamie Smith at the moment, but Root's going to play for another 2 to 4 years. Harry Brook is obviously around for a long period of time. None of them are going to move for Pope to get a better position, are they? Pope is going to move so that they get the positions that they want.
Yeah, I think Jamie Smith might die if he has to bat higher up the order if he's going to keep as much as he is, right?
Well, I mean, the whole Jamie Smith one is probably a completely different conversation, but you're right. But the point being is, if Jamie Smith probably doesn't need to bat at seven, right? Jamie Smith can bat at six, you know, especially when Stokes retires, or Stokes might go to seven, which is the other option. I don't think they want to do that, though, because there's too many right-handers in a row and blah, 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 blah. But the point being is that Smith is good enough that you might move the batting order for Smith. Pope is probably always going to be a situation where he has to be moved for other people.
Yeah, completely agree with you. Before we move on, let's just take a quick break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back.
Brian Lara used pot plants to work on his placement. John Wright glued his glove to his bat. Sachin Tendulkar dug up practice pitches. Tatenda Taibu cut the top off his bat. Claire Taylor used a hockey grip. Steve Smith was from tennis. Dean Jones would call phantom runs. And Victor Trumpa turned the Nets into a war zone to survive. The best batters in the world do whatever they have to make runs. We have told their stories in our new book, The Art of Batting.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Footmarks. I'm Varun and Jared. Jared, so let's talk about Marwan Attapattu for a bit. Right? So he debuts in 1990, where I believe from 1990 to 1992, he plays a test each year, I think. And he has one of the worst starts that anyone has probably ever had.
He makes a pair in 1990. He makes one run in 1992. And then he makes a pair in 1994. Am I getting that right? I think that's right off the top of my head.
Yes, and then one run in six innings.
Yeah, and after 10 test matches or 8 test matches or something, he's averaging about 10. It's like...
Yes. Nine matches.
Yeah, 9 matches. It is. And a top score of like 29 as well. Like, so yes. It's not as if he started to make runs in the fourth and fifth test matches. It's one of those situations where he was probably lucky he was dropped, because my guess is he was thrown in a little bit too early before he was ready. By the time he comes into Test cricket and is playing regular cricket, he's clearly a very, very good player. And he goes on to have a fantastic record for an Asian opener in that period of time. And I know that when I was writing this, I was asking some of the, you know, some former players about him. Everyone was like, no, this guy could play. He was a really top level player. But everyone knows about his start, and he's kind of, you know, there's always an element of that on the back end of it. But everyone thought he could play. But what we found during this is that he also happened to be one of the worst starters in the history of the game. Not just his career, but by innings. He basically would either make runs or not make runs. He was a binary player, right? And we found this out because Ollie Pope is also a binary player, right? And so we found about four or five different players that we looked at that were very similar. Most of them were openers, I think you pointed out. And which makes sense of if you get past the new ball and you're set, then you'll go on and make runs, and you don't always get past the new ball. So, you know, there's a lovely section in there about Grant Flower. One day you and I are going to have to do like a 10,000 word essay on Grant Flower, because he is one of the more fascinating cricketers in the history of the game in ODI cricket and in Test cricket. But, you know, we talked about Grant Flower. We talked about Marvin Adipatu going on to be a fantastic player. But the one I thought was more interesting was Dennis Amos, who I'm assuming you didn't know much about before.
I've definitely heard of the name. I think it's just it keeps coming up. But I know it was a great, was it good or great batter? One of those. I know definitely people rated him.
Yeah,
that much I remember.
But it's so he makes 22 scores over 50, and 11 of those are hundreds, and 8 of those are over 150. It's one of the more bizarre records that you will ever see. And I think we worked it out for the piece, didn't he? He basically made triple figures and single figures like 42% of the time, and double figures only 58% of the time, which is not how normal players go. And so he was, because he was, a more of a middle order player and everything else, he was sort of the player that we looked at more with from a Pope perspective of, I talked to quite a few people about Dennis Amos as well in the press box, and they were all, they remembered the bad starts, but they didn't quite remember them to the level that we noticed. But what they really remembered was once he was in, that was it. There was no getting Dennis Amos out, right? Like once he was in, and if you look at Ollie Pope, once he gets past, 15, 20, 25, it's a very similar thing. If he's in, he just goes absolutely nuts, right? And it becomes a very, very big score. He has, I think, we didn't put this in the piece, but I think he has like a weakness around the 80s. Well, something like that, 70s or 80s, where he goes out a little bit more, but then he just sprints on again.
Yeah, so Jared, I think about the starting bit, I wanted to ask you something because I was thinking of recently. Was we know that I think almost every batter in the history of Test cricket is the most vulnerable in the initial 5 to 10 runs, right? And that's not just a Pope thing. It's like almost every batter is actually a bad starter. I was wondering, because you were talking with Robbie about batters being in subconscious mind and conscious mind. So one question I have for you is one of the reasons why batters are more vulnerable when they start batting is because they're conscious. And the difference between like a great batter and the ordinary one, the great batters get into the subconscious state much sooner than the ordinary ones do. And with Pope's case, it takes him a lot longer. Or he's even more conscious when he's batting, where it's like, obviously I don't play cricket, but like I know this when I'm starting other things, like if I have to do like work or something. Like it's almost like when you're starting, you're almost aware of every like molecule of air around you. And then once you're in the zone. I wonder, is that what happens with batters?
Yeah, I think it's very similar. So I've noticed in my innings that when I go out there, I'm so hyper-conscious of everything when I'm out to begin with, you know, where I'm standing, everything else. And then once I get to, it's usually between around 10 or 15. Sometimes it might be earlier, sometimes it might be later. But once I get to about 10 or 15, I'm just in a state of batting, right? And, you know, that brings about its own problems for me because of my limitations as a player and, you know, my arrogance and trying to hit boundaries all the time and all this sort of stuff. But at that point, I'm just flowing. Whereas early on, I can feel those sort of things going. So I think that is an issue. I think the issue for people like Ollie Pope and Marcus North and Dennis Amos and Marvin Adipatu is it's probably a longer conscious era than anyone else, right? They probably have an era where it just takes them longer to get into it. And, you know, have you ever studied flow state?
I think I've come across it somewhere. I've not studied it.
It's one of the more interesting things in the world because a lot of people have studied it over the last 10 or 15 years, and there's some, you know, really good books about it and everything else, but it's not, we don't really know how to make it happen, right? And so we know, did you watch much of Marcus North? Is this a player that was on your radar, or is it just before your time? Probably just before your time.
I didn't watch him. I know Marcus North because I played a lot of Ashes Cricket 09, and I remember distinctly making a lot of hundreds with Marcus North.
So I remember talking to a lot of cricket experts where I said, I don't think Marcus North will stay around, whatever. And he was like, when he was making runs, everyone would look at me like I was a sociopath, right? Later, I was like, wait, what are you talking about? This guy is obviously a test cricketer. But what they were missing is all the other times when he couldn't start. And so Marcus North just couldn't get past 10, right? And when he got past 10, he probably made 100. And so you had this very, very weird situation with someone like Marcus North where that was very common. If you could get Ollie Pope, Dennis Amos, Marcus North, Marvin Adipatu, you know, Grant Flower, all these players, and actually, well, maybe not Grant Flower, he is a different case on his own, but all those other guys I just mentioned, Sean Marsh is another really good one on this. We mentioned Marcus North and Sean Marsh in the book about this very topic. If you could work out how to get them into that flow state quicker or get them how to feel settled quicker, whatever, however you want to put it, they are probably some of the best test batters of all time. And I'm not, that's, like, I know that sounds like hyperbole, but it's not, because they are better than great players when they're in, but they can't get in, right? Yes. And so, you know, that's the big difference of a player like that. And I'm not, you know, that's the ball game, right? If you can't get in, you can't get in, you know, however you want to look at it. But yeah, so I do think that that is an element of it. And Ollie Pope clearly has this. And you look at him sometimes, and I think the to go back to the Nostradamus thing from before, I was watching him, Varun, going, oh, he's lost. I could see that he wasn't in the right spot at that time. And there's a few times when I've watched him and I'm just like, oh, he's lost. And I don't know how to, I don't know what it is that I'm subconsciously seeing. Because if you ask me to write down the list, I'm not even sure I could come up with it. But I can tell from my vantage point, he doesn't know what he's going to do next ball, right? He's not sure of himself and everything. And then you could see when he switches and suddenly it's like, it's almost he's on autopilot. And as you said, that's probably just the subconscious taking over.
Yeah, I think it's the way sometimes with Pope, it's like, do you know how when you're like playing a cricket game, like you can shift in the crease? And then like, so I think accidentally there'll be times where like you move it too far and the batter is like standing well outside of. That's what there are times I feel like Pope is doing.
Yeah, like he's lost, right? Like he's not standing in the spot he should be for that ball.
Yeah, I think with Ollie Pope, the stupidest stats I think I've come across, I think we've done a lot of stupid things, would be his median balls per dismissal for anyone with 3,000 runs is only better than Stuart Broad and Shane Warne. I love that so much because it's so utterly idiotic. And I had to double check it so many times because I was like, there is no way this is true.
Yeah, but we had to, to be fair to Ollie Pope, we did change it and make it, well, not even to be fair to Ollie Pope, maybe to be unfair to Ollie Pope, we did actually change it to top 7 players at one stage as well. But the fact is that have you ever noticed how often you look up batting stats and Stuart Broad and Shane Warne pop up because they played so many tests and they could both hold a bat, so they make runs. And so the amount of times I've come up with a stat and I have to change it because of fucking Broad or Warne, right? But I like the fact that we could use this here. And those are two really, really interesting cricketers. So Shane Warne was a really bad starter. I think Shane Warne would have been he was a good number 8, but he would have been a fantastic number 8 if he just would have been able to start better. And he had this weird technique where he kind of shuffle in front of the stumps and play across the line early on. And he just missed them occasionally, right? Once he was in, he had very good hand-eye coordination, which, you know, you could tell from how good he was in slips. But he had to be in to be able to do that. Broad, obviously, a completely different character that we know about and all sorts of things. Broad's about 4 different batters in his career as well at different times. But the fact that Ollie Pope is even being mentioned near them compared to, you know, look, there is a point in this graphic, in this piece, where we compare him favorably, not favorably, but we compare him nicely compared to Kane Williamson. And then there's another point where we compare him unfavorably compared to Broad and Warne. Like, it just shows you how random Ollie Pope is as a player.
Yeah, I think it's like nothing actually makes sense. So I think one we have to talk about is Ollie Pope by innings, right? There is like he starts off brilliantly. I think so from memory, he's averaging everything over 50 in the first innings. When we looked this up, I don't can't remember if it changes a lot by that point. But and then he just gets worse.
Until
yeah, he has 52 in the first innings, 41.8 in the second, 22.5 in the third, and I think 16 in the fourth innings, right? He just keeps getting worse. So then I think we were discussing, we're like, who is his nearest neighbors? So I remember I was looking at the like cosine similarity matrix, which is like, let's just do this objectively instead of vibes. And that the two names I remember finding was Steve Waugh and Steve Smith. Never in my life, Jared, did I ever think I'd put Ollie Pope in the same sentence as those two.
We took the Steve Smith one out. The Steve Waugh one out, and Varun was so upset because it was just because it was telling the same story twice and I didn't really need to do it. But we did have a whole section written about how similar he was to Steve Waugh. And I think the line I used was the Walmart Steve Waugh, right? Like, the absolute budget version of that. But yeah, and then I was lucky. I think I mentioned that to John Norman. He was like, oh yeah, we had Ollie Pope in recently and he was talking about how he doesn't sleep during a test match. And we're like, well, Steve Smith doesn't sleep during a test match. And so suddenly you have this. And we looked up first class, his first class numbers, Varun. He must sleep during first class cricket, right? Because he doesn't do the same thing in first class cricket. It's so weird.
Like, it's so strange. I think when I was upset with the Steve Waugh being removed, I wasn't aware of the, like, he doesn't sleep bit. Then I'm like, the moment I found that out, I think when I was, we were checking the piece, I was like, oh, that makes so much more sense why we removed Steve Waugh from it. I'm like, even Steve Smith, Jerry, we're like, at one point, Steve Smith was probably the best since Bradman. And we're comparing with Ollie Pope. I'm like, it's so weird, I think it's.
And that's one of the reasons that this piece sort of, you know, does explode in so many different directions, right? It is that Even when he's good at something, it's extreme. And then when he's bad at something, it's extreme. You know, to go back to the Shane Warne Broad thing, it's like in every sort of direction that you go in, there's an extreme statistic about him. And what's interesting is he's quite a mid player, right? Like he's not he's not terrible. I know that, you know, a lot of people would be like, he's terrible. And it's like for a modern era, I think we proved that he's okay, right? I think for the piece, we took out the whole Ian Bell comparison. We had, KL Rahul and Ian Bell. I can't remember if that was one of the things that I cut. But
I think we cut both of them.
Yeah. And if you compare him to Ian Bell, he stands up pretty good, I would say, right? And people never thought of Ian Bell as a bad player. They thought maybe he was, again, a bit mid for someone as talented as him. And we might put that piece up because we do have about 1,500 words on Ian Bell, KL Rahul, and Ollie Pope together. As this sort of weird triumvirate of players that are all quite similar in different ways. And so you end up in this situation where you're like, okay, so he's mid player, but he's a mid player only because he's extreme in every different direction. Like he's not a mid player. He's not like, who's another good mid player? He's not like Faf du Plessis. Faf du Plessis is quite a mid player, right, in Test cricket, where you're just like,
yeah, that's fair.
Slightly above average at little different things, a couple of dips here and there, but good player. We all would say he's good.
Faf is the perfect role player.
Exactly, right?
Yeah, like but, you want him between AB de Villiers and Hoshi Mamla and Callis. You don't want, he's not the star of the team, is what you're saying, right? Similar with
exactly.
Pope is what we're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what Pope is. But Pope gets there by being the one of the best first innings players of all time and one of the worst fourth innings players of all time. Pope gets there by being marginally better than Broad and Warne, right? But also making a ton of runs and having his record up there not that far off from someone like Kane Williamson. Like, how do you work these things out, dude? It's so bizarre. Ross Taylor couldn't see at night or when the clouds were in. Eventually, he had to see an eye specialist who would fix his eyesight. In the 2 years before the change, he still averaged more than 50 in international cricket. The top level of batting talent can basically see in the dark. That is who we are talking about in our new book, The Art of Batting. Head over and order your copy today.
Yeah, speaking of the fourth innings, I think for a top seven batter, he's got the worst average, I think, for a minimum of 20 innings. He's worse than Marlon Samuels, Jared. Well, who the hell talks about Marlon Samuels in Test cricket?
I think the interesting thing that you point out there is we looked at top seven players as well. Because if you do top six players, you're like, oh, okay, that's bad. But when you factor in top seven, there's a lot of shit wicketkeepers in the world, right? Yeah. And they're tired as fuck, man. And we know that. We know that wicketkeeping averages go down in the fourth innings compared to batters in general, right? and he's still worse, and he's hardly kept. And we haven't even talked about the fact that, you know, we briefly talked about it before, that sort of the treatment of Ollie Pope is, okay, so you're going to bat at number four, despite the fact you're not, clearly not a number four, and we're going to give that a go. Now you're going to bat at number six. Oh, you failed at number six. You're going to come back at number three, despite the fact that's the hardest position. Oh, you're doing quite well at number three. Do you want a wicket keep for a little while? How about vice captaincy? Have you thought about vice captaincy? Like, what the fuck do England think? It's like, anytime they have a question, Ollie Pope is the answer? Like, what the fuck is wrong with them?
Mm-hmm. And he's also at the same time public enemy number one. I don't know how Zach Crawley's escaped every single criticism possible. Whereas I think with Crawley, there seems to be an element of, we know he's shit, so we're going to stop talking about the fact that he's shit. Whereas with Ollie Pope, I feel like there is never even a glimmer of hope where people are like, okay, is this actually going to be the time where, like, he's going to be good? Because I think we were talking about the KL Rahul comparison, right? I think after the third test, both had the same average in a similar amount of games. But when KL Rahul gets 100, I think entire Indian fandom is like, okay, is this finally going to be KL Rahul's big series? And then all the Sky commentators are all praising him because of his technique. Whereas Pope gets 100 in the first test match as well, right, Jared? Not a single person was hopeful. All of us were almost could put money on the fact that he's going to get out cheaply in the same test match. Right? And I feel bad for him at times.
No, that's a very, very good point. And I do think now that it's funny because he is actually about to come into his prime years as a batter. And him and Crawley are both about to come in. And they've been so decided on in some ways as players. And I'm like, there is a really big chance that they get better, 15% better, 20% better in the next 4 years. But none of us believe that, right? None of us actually believe that. You and I can both do the numbers and be like, they should make more runs. We both could see that. We could also see how in a year's time, neither of them are playing Test cricket, right? Like,
yes.
Not
even a year's time, Jared. I don't think I could guarantee, like, with reasonable certainty that both of them will play by the fifth test of the Ashes.
Exactly. Well, I mean, the only reason Crawley will is because otherwise it's the worst investment in there. I mean, the sunk cost fallacy of Zach Crawley is so high at this point. He kind of has to play the fifth. If he has a Marvin Adepatu or a Ken Rutherford series, they're still going to be like, sorry, you're just going to have to keep going, dude.
I think India's sunk cost fallacy or Shubman Gill, just to give people like almost like comparative where people are like, oh, the Shubman, is there an element of sunk cost fallacy with Shubman Gill before the series, right? Right. I think that's England's Crawley. So, it's weird.
But Crawley's like 3 years older than Gill and was never. When Gill was bad, he was averaging more than Crawley. it's like, I don't, you know. It's a fascinating one with Pope in any sort of direction that you stretch.
Yeah, also, I think we were just talking about, like, everyone's like, well, Pope should be dropped from the series, right, after the series. And he outperformed India's number threes. He was, by some reasonable distance as well. I think he was, what was he averaging, like, 34 in the series compared to India's number threes, which was 25, 26. And I think you can make a very good argument. Number three is the one position where I think England clearly outright beat the Indian batters. Hmm. Because every other position, it's either evens or India's maybe slightly better.
Yeah, but I think if Karan Nair suddenly was qualifying for England or Sai Sadasha was qualifying for England, they'd be playing at number three the next day. I mean, you're right. Karan Nair got himself in a couple of times and Sai Sadasha got himself in a couple of times. They just never got on to get that big knock. And that goes back to Pope has averaged 34 in what is quite a high scoring series. So I think we have to put that with context. But you're right. He did outscore the Indian players in that position.
Could you not argue that Indian number three is average 26 and also what was a high scoring series, right? So it's like, even when he's good, he's still bad. It's like, I agree with you, Jared. I think if England had the option, they'd take Karan Nair or Sai Sudarshan, right? They'd pick him tomorrow.
Definitely. They'd probably pick, would they pick Manas even now in Manas's form? Probably, right?
Maybe. Actually, they might not pick him because of his style of batting.
If Tristan Stubbs was in England, he'd be batting at three, wouldn't he?
Probably.
Yeah.
I think that's fair.
So you know, you've got players who haven't really made a lot of test runs who would just come into that spot.
Yeah, also, like, amongst all of those, like, going back to the original point, like, Pope just gets bowled versus pace more than, like, anyone, like, we were expecting, I think, which is very weird, I think.
I think this is the reason that he has struggles in the fourth innings. But it's interesting when you show me the list of the guys who get bowled the most versus pace. It's not a bad list to be on, is it? Like, there's some all-time goats on that list. And so The difference is, I think a lot of guys who get bowled a lot traditionally would probably be more guys who would have stayed leg side of the ball, right? And so they're trying to smash things through the offside. And so they're staying on the leg side to play those shots. That's not really how Pope plays. In fact, I would argue that he kind of moves across his stumps quite a bit and tries to flick the ball from off stump to leg. So he shouldn't be bowled as much as he is. It's almost... He should be out LBW more. So I don't really understand how he manages to be bowled so much. But I do think it plays a part in him not being good in the fourth innings. That and obviously the sleep. Yeah. And yeah, probably so spin. Just, I mean, if you put all those things together.
Give people an idea, right? I think just to give people an idea what list we're talking about, like the highest percentage of bowls is Wally Hammond.
Pretty good.
At 38. I think this is Ted Dexter, I believe.
Ted Dexter, yeah.
So Dexter, yeah, at 36.5. Clem Hill at 34%.
All three of those are top 100 batters. You've got Roston Chase after Pope. Okay, so Roston Chase not as good.
Yeah, Alan Knott. We have Gundappa Vishwanath. It's such a weird list. It's either you have wicket keepers or some of the greatest batters in the history of Test cricket. And then we have Pope.
Yep. I think some of those guys are more sort of leg side of the ball. And I just don't think Pope is. I don't know how it's ended up. So with Roston Chase, I just think Roston Chase struggles when the ball's over 135, 138, right? Like, very good player, a spin Roston Chase, but he's probably a first-class batter rather than a test batter when it comes to fast bowling. And so you can blast through him occasionally, right? And you have a look at the amount of times he's just trapped on the crease and he's got no shot. Pope isn't even kind of like that. He gets bowled in a variety of ways. And I don't know if it is because he is flicking across the line, but he should still be out LBW more, and he's not. It is specifically bold that he gets. But just to go back on the first class thing, this is where I think it's really interesting. When you look at all the skills that Ollie Pope has, right, and the fact that he doesn't struggle in the fourth innings, that there aren't as many spinners in the fourth innings, that there aren't as many wickets that are deteriorating everything else, I think his counting numbers actually make sense. And all of his fragilities are actually exploited at the test level rather than the first class level, which doesn't always happen. Right? Like, Roston Chase might be a perfect example of another player who's probably fairly similar to. It doesn't usually happen in that way. And so with Pope, what you see is a guy who's still averaging, 55 in county cricket. And yet, when he plays in test cricket, he's so far off that mark. And the reason is because of all these other things that he doesn't have to deal with in first class cricket that he suddenly has to go up against in test cricket. And that's, at that point, he starts to make a little bit more sense. So I wonder if he had Crawley's first-class record, I don't think Pope is playing test cricket.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think with Crawley, there is at least there's an element of pretty privilege. Whereas I think Pope, I'm not saying he's an ugly batter, but it's like, he's not very, I don't know, I can't, he's not as watchable to me as Zach Crawley is when he's in float.
He's not ugly, though. Like, I mean, you're right. I understand your overall point, but he's not. Like, he does get compared to Ian Bell a lot, and Ian Bell was one of the prettier modern players, but he's not Ian Bell, is he? Like, he's just obviously not pretty in that same kind of way. Like, none of us would disagree with that at all. He's just not in that same level.
All right, so Jared, just to wrap this up, what would you say has been your favorite Ollie Pope stat that we came up with?
Oh, my God. I don't even know if it's a stat. I think it's the fact that he debuts at number 7 in a first-class team against county players. He goes out to a Zimbabwean under-19 player, right? Like, I think it's the randomness of it came from nowhere and it's still, all this sort of weird treatment and everything else. I think it's probably that. It's funny, there was a bunch of drunk fans one night, so I went to a pub after play one night, and a bunch of drunk fans, you would love this game, by the way, I actually don't want to tell you about this game that they came up with, but it's basically, you know, with darts, you count down from 301 to zero and you have to end up at exactly zero. They play a game like that with football and cricket, where you have to do it with like football goal scorers, or you have to do it with batting averages. Right.
Oh, okay.
And unfortunately for the poor guy they threw me up against, he was a little bit drunk. And not only, like, I knew the players and I knew their exact averages almost every time. So it was very easy. I think I just went like Bradman, Headley, Sutcliffe, and then Inzamam Wokes. I might be missing someone in that, but I got it almost within two straight away. Right. But it is a fun game. I think you have to take Bradman out of that game for it to be more fun.
That's fair.
But they were talking about the Pope piece, right? And they were like, so is it good or not? And I was like, I don't know. I the more I learn about him, I don't know how you felt, but the more I learn about him, I was like, I don't know how I feel about Ollie Pope now at all. And I don't think I had strong Pope opinions coming in to mm-hmm. writing this piece. It's not like Wagner. When I, you know, this is a very similar piece than we did on Wagner or Ishan Sharma, right? Those guys had so many strong opinions on. This is going to be the piece that defines these guys. With Ollie Pope, I was like, oh my God, am I writing the magnum opus on Ollie Pope? Am I writing the definitive piece on Ollie Pope and where he ends up? And how have I ended up as this person? And so these guys are asking me that question, and I'm like, I don't know how to answer it. Like, the only thing I can answer is they said, is he going to make runs in the second innings? I was like, no, he's not going to make runs in the second innings. That's all I know about Ollie Pope.
Yeah. Although, like, one of his best innings was the 196 versus India, where he just reverse swept everyone. Very Ollie Pope, right? I think, so yeah. All right, so that's the end of this video, which was, I think, probably one of my favorite things we've ever done together has been this video, just because it's so bizarre. I think these are big, the best footmarks when we're just talking about someone completely random, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, and look, that's what, it's one of the great things about good areas. And I did this video for this guy the other day, Owen Connolly, who he does a new sports podcast, and he wanted to talk to storytellers. And you can find it up on Instagram. But I was basically saying, if I'd have gone to Cricket Info and be like, so I'm going to write a 7,000-word piece on Neil Wagner being the most unique player ever. Like, Cricket Info would have been like, what? What are you talking about? No. They might have let me do it because I would have badgered them. But there's no way they would have done it. If I'd have gone with this Ollie Pope piece, and remember, we didn't even know what this Ollie Pope piece was. So I would have been going, so I'm going to write a feature on Ollie Pope, and it's going to be like 3,000 words. They would have been like, oh, I don't know. Then I would have come back with a 7,000-word treatise on him, like, you know, like the Unabomber Manifesto on Ollie Pope, right? And they would have been like, no, you can't write this piece, right? And mm-hmm. it's one of the great things about Good Areas where you guys didn't even know what I was doing. Like, you just... halfway through, you suddenly realized that I'd gone mad because I kept saying, we need this and we need that. And you're like, there's 45 graphics we've already made, right? Yes. Like, by the time the team realized how big this project was, I'd already finished it. And it's one of the great things about Good Areas that, like, everyone backs it. And it's just like, no, actually, we do need a 7,000-word piece on Ollie Pope. In fact, the world has always needed a 7,000-word piece on Ollie Pope. And that's why I love it. And then we get to do a podcast like this as well, where I think it still shows how confused and baffled we are by the enigma that is Ollie Pope.
Yeah, I think I was just about to say, you were saying that, like, oh, we had no idea where the piece was going. We did the piece, Jared, and I still don't know what the piece is about. So I think that kind of sums it up, yeah. So thank you so much for listening, guys. I think make sure to subscribe, bookmark goodareas.co. It's a one-stop shop for everything. We hope you had a good time listening to this. We'll see you again on all this usual stuff.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vasudevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.